I am Plata on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Dina Del Bucchi has just published her first collection of short stories. Don't Tell Me What to Do is getting wonderful notices, including starred reviews in Quill and Quire and Publishers Weekly. The collection features funny stories featuring women. Some are unruly, some are weird, but they are all fascinating. They're flawed, but they're human. These stories are emotional and often bittersweet, and the characters and situations that Ms. Del Bucchi presents are refreshing. As one critic stated, we're in the midst of a strong debut. Dina Del Bucchi is the author of three collections of poetry, including Coping with Emotions and Otters and Blind Items. She was first on this program in 2015 with Daniel Zamparelli when they published the collection Rom-Com. Dina is the editor of Poetry is Dead magazine and the artistic director of the Real Vancouver Writers series. She hosts the podcast Can't Lit. This new collection is published by Arsenal Pulp Press. Please welcome back to the Plant on the Line program, Dina Del Bucchi. Ms. Del Bucchi, good morning.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So I was telling you just before we started recording that these are, in this book, Don't Tell Me What to Do, just such interesting women. And they're the sort of women that we don't usually read about. Was that on purpose, I guess, on your part?
In some ways, I think I wanted to explore a type of woman, female character that was interesting to me, that, yeah, in some ways I felt like I hadn't been reading enough of. I think there are characters like that out there, but I think that I, we can always use more.
Yeah, they're the sort of women that a lot of us probably know, or we've seen but don't know much about. Is that your experience? I mean, have you seen these women around, say?
Yeah, definitely, for sure. I mean, I think I, both growing up and then also living in Vancouver, have seen these types of women in all sorts of different ways, all sorts of different places. So I actually think in pop culture, a lot of the time we see the same trope mm-hmm. of women characters, and I definitely was trying to explore something that went a little bit grittier. The idea of, like, the anti-hero, mm-hmm. whether it's, you know, something like Mad Men, which is
yeah.
a very realistic program, or even something like a superhero trope,
yeah.
Very often those characters are not female characters. They're not the women characters.
Yeah.
So I think that was a little bit in my mind.
And I'm reading this, and then I realize the sort of constraints that we put on people, women especially, that we expect certain things of them, and unfairly. But I guess that society does that, doesn't it?
Oh, definitely, definitely. And I think, of course, that's always slowly changing.
Yeah.
But for sure there's... what am I trying to say? Like, I think it's this way that so often women are put into limiting roles mm-hmm. in the real world. Like, even in terms of our personality, like, we're not allowed to have certain types of ambition, or we're not allowed to exhibit certain emotions.
Yeah.
Specifically, you know, anger or... If there's a vengefulness, it comes across in this, like, Glenn Close and Fatal Attraction way. It has to be about something. It has to be about men. It has to be yeah. about our relationship to them. And I like playing around that idea.
Yeah. Like, the woman in one of the stories, I think it's the title story, she has an affair. And
yes.
She steals.
Yes.
Yet, at the same time, I mean, you know, if a guy did that, if it was a male in the story,
yeah.
people would just sort of, you know, just roll their eyes. You know, there we go again. But in this case, there's nothing, I mean, there's obviously something wrong with her stealing. But, I mean, other than that, it's kind of fun to see her take that road trip and spend the money. And, I mean, I was fascinated with how she takes all the toonies.
Yeah.
And has to figure out how to spend them, because she wants to buy a bunch of stuff too. right. without so getting caught.
Live her life.
Yeah, without getting caught. And you know, how many toonies can you get away with at the bank or at the store paying for stuff?
Right. Yeah, totally. And I think depending on the writing and the storytelling, I think we might be okay if a male character was doing that. But at the same time, it's just about being able to see the motivation of that character and have some empathy for where they came from and what they've gone through and why they're making those choices.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean you have to be fully on their side. I think that's part of the complicated world that people create with fiction, because we are complicated people. We're not purely good or purely bad, and we're yeah. making mistakes, and people don't always know our motivation. That's why fiction is great, because you can go deeper into who those characters are and why they're making the choices they are, whether they're, you know, something like stealing and cheating. And I mean, I don't even consider it cheating. Like, that guy was barely dialed in.
Yeah, the guy that she was with. Yeah, the guy that she was with before. Yeah, he
didn't care.
Yeah, and when people read the story, they'll understand why she does what she does.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
So for me, yeah, that's my concern as a writer, to get the reader, hopefully, to see that.
Yeah, when you're writing about relationships that men and women have, it seems that they're from a place of you wanting to say something about how we interact with one another. Does that come from a place of wisdom that you want to say impart to the reader, or are they just the fears and hopes that you might have that you put on the page to say work out?
I think it's definitely a mixture of those things. Fear is a great word. And also fantasy, yeah. I think. Like the idea of these stories, and as a writer, if you choose to go down that road, is that you can, you know, create whatever narratives you want for these characters, and they're not you, but you can allow them to explore those deeper emotional wells and kind of play around with why they're behaving the way they are and why they're reacting to another character's behavior the way that they are.
Yeah, you know, and the other thing that struck me as I'm reading this is, I met you before, so I know how funny you are, and I know how you understand humor a great deal, and it shows in the writing. I guess, is there a lesson in how humor can get you through a lot of what life throws at you, say?
Oh, I think for sure. That's definitely either a coping mechanism for me or just the way that I filter things or the way that I see the world. I also think that sometimes the way we tell stories can come across better to a reader or to an audience if there's some humor there. But if you don't have the emotional backbone, then you also aren't able to, you know, give as full of an experience than if it was just a bunch of jokes.
Yeah.
Like the craft of the story still has to be in there. But for sure, I mean, also, I want to write books that I would want to read.
Uh-huh.
And I really love reading funny books. I feel like there aren't enough books that are really funny and that play with humor. We need more.
Yeah. So humor is definitely needed in a relationship between a man and a woman.
Yeah.
I guess that's a given, isn't it? I mean,
I think any relationship, relationships, romantic or platonic, you definitely, I would hope, need and crave and get some humor and some lightheartedness and some laughs, especially during the darkest moments that we have to endure in life.
Yeah. Now, I understand you teach humor writing at UBC, is that right?
Yeah, I'm an adjunct lecturer at UBC. I taught this course last year, and I'm teaching it again this year. Yeah, it's called Introduction to Comedic Forms.
And so what are some of the students that take a course like that? Are they wanting to be, say, joke writers on television? Is it?
Some of them do.
Yeah.
Some of them want to be joke writers. Some of them want to do stand-up. Some of them do stand-up.
Uh-huh.
Some of them just think they're not funny and they want to be funnier. There are so many different reasons. It's a bigger lecture class, so there are a lot of different types of students in the course. So they're all kind of there for different reasons. But there are a lot of them, I'd say, not a lot, but like probably, you know, a dozen or so that really take it seriously as a form that they want to explore and that they want to really understand and learn and find a way to, you know, make some kind of a go of being funny and learning how to write that way.
And are you, do you have any students that you've come across that say want to write humorous fiction like you have in this collection?
No, that's definitely never really the case. There's lots that want to write like personal essays, nonfiction. Fiction, definitely. At the beginning of the term, I ask everybody what types of comedy they enjoy and that they watch or that they read. And fiction and poetry, which I also do cover in the course, are the two lowest percentages by far. I think a lot of times people just aren't as familiar with that. And I don't know if it's because technically it's a more elevated form, quote unquote, I'm definitely not making any judgment there, or if it's just because obviously video and audio and anything written online that's shorter is just something that's more accessible for them, as opposed to having to read a 200-page, 300-page, 400-page novel or a book.
But don't you think that the people picking up this book might cause them aspiration to do what you've done here?
I mean, I would really hope so.
Yeah.
I definitely know that reading a lot of weirder and funnier short stories, specifically as an undergrad, after having read, you know, mostly very serious material, really did open up to me the idea that I could write fiction and poetry in a way that was not this angst-ridden, you know, idea that a 20-year-old might have about what you need to do to be a very serious writer.
Because I mean, you do. I mean, I'm not telling tales out of school here, but I mean, the reviews have talked about just how good this collection is, and I think a lot of people are probably wanting more of that. I think that's why it's done so well, is because it's something that a lot of people haven't read heretofore.
Yeah, I mean, I really hope that is the case, and I know that a lot of funny books and, you know, have come out in the last few years, and I think it's really great to see that people are doing that, both with fiction and with poetry, which are things that aren't necessarily always associated with, you know, they're not the number one thing people think of or go to when they think of humorous writing.
Yeah. What was there a temptation to say, go beyond the short story with some of these women and maybe expand some of their stories and into book length, say?
You know what? Not for this, not for any of the stories in this particular book. In some ways, the title story, I thought I could have written more. And same thing with the closing story about the model who runs the cult.
Yeah.
I feel like I could have, both of those are the two, I think, longest stories in the book. And part of me, you know, at some point was like, yeah, these could be longer. But I do feel satisfied with the length that they are and the way that they've ended up.
That's the thing that strikes me in reading the collection, because this is a collection of short stories. You don't have the book length to waste, say, with a lot of, so every word that you use, every phrase that you turn, is almost calculated. There's nothing wasted. And I guess that sort of discipline comes from poetry, right?
I would definitely say so. I wrote this book. One of the oldest stories in the book is from 2001. And it's completely changed since then. It's the title story.
Yeah.
And there used to be a male protagonist. I completely changed the direction, everything. But in the time that I was writing this, I wrote all of the poetry books that have come out, and I was writing all of the stuff in tandem. And I definitely think having the two disciplines, practicing them side by side, was extremely helpful in both directions.
So what do you think changed in the 15, 16 years or so since you started the story till the one that we read in this book?
Do you think? Took me years to come back to it. It probably took me 10 years even to just go back and look at it again and realize that there was something there. I'd obviously been thinking about it and wanted to revisit those characters. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I just had a realization that why was I telling this man's story when obviously she was the more interesting character.
Yeah.
She was the one taking action. She was the one who really went on an adventure of some description. And, yeah, that's kind of where my brain took me.
Yeah, and do you think in the 10 years or so, whatever personal development you experienced, you think that fed into it?
I think for sure that it did. I think in some ways I feel like a late bloomer in terms of I grew up in a small town. I think that my mindset and all sorts of other things about the way, not that, you know, my parents are amazing, but it's just a very different environment, and I think it took me a while to kind of embrace certain types of female empowerment, and once I did, I think that also changed the collection. And also being able to, you know, meet lots of young women as a writer or as a mentor, or, you know, them coming to my events or talking to them at events. The internet, of course, being able to just communicate with people online who are, you know, young and smart and more vibrant than I am, their perspectives surely helped.
So Fruitvale is a quieter place in Vancouver, I guess?
It's pretty, I mean, there's loud people there, but it's not busy. Yeah.
Is it one of those places that shuts down after a certain hour?
Yeah, there's bars that stay open.
Yeah.
But, like, most of the, there's one street, really.
Uh-huh.
That has stuff on it, like stores. So they're definitely all shut down.
Yeah. You've lived in Vancouver for how long?
I moved here. I spent a little bit of time there, but not much, since 1998.
Yeah. So 19, 20 years or so. When you do go back, because I understand your family's still there.
My family does still live there, yeah.
Does it still feel like home, or do you feel like you're in Vancouver right now?
I mean, it doesn't necessarily feel like home, but it feels like a somewhat comfortable place that I can visit. Mm. And I still know some people that live there. My family lives there. And I think that part of it feels homey.
Yeah.
But I feel that if I just went back and no one was there, it would have a completely different feeling. There's always, I think, some level of nostalgia.
You never really leave home.
When you return.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's beautiful, and it's quiet, and it is lovely. But when I'm there, I'm always like, okay, well, I know that I'm leaving. Like, I won't be here for a longer time. And just, definitely a small town life was not something that was appealing to me.
So when you come to Vancouver, because you're such a part of the cultural, literary life of this town, do you think you could have imagined that for yourself coming here, say when you were younger, that this was a place that you could take on and be a part of, say?
You know what? I don't really think I thought about it initially at all. I did feel kind of like a bumpkin, and I was like, I'm coming to the city and I'm going to live there and I'm going to do fancy city things. And I did. In some ways, but I never really thought that much about community until it was quite a few years in.
Yeah.
And realizing at first that I wasn't a part of anything because I wasn't participating. I wasn't going to events. And once I started to do that, I realized that there were lots of opportunities and amazing people that live here and work here and write here and produce shows, and that there were just yeah, there were things happening that I had no idea. And as soon as I started to get involved, I couldn't get out.
Yeah.
And you know, you turn into, it's the Godfather. You want to get out, but they keep pulling you back in.
Yeah.
But not that you don't actually want to leave, but you just are, like, in there.
Yeah. There is that feeling, though. I mean, I'm thinking of a couple women in the book where they want something better, and they end up doing it out of their own volition, that they actually get it. It's one thing to want something, and it's another thing to go out there and get it and do it. And a couple of the women do that in this book, don't they?
They do. I mean, I think earlier when we talked about emotions and fantasy, I think that that is part of it for me, the idea of these women having a dream, however big or small or absurd or achievable, but they're going after it. And I think to me that speaks to this idea of fantasies and daydreams that we all have. And what would it look like if we acted on them? What would it look like if we figured out the way to make something happen for us that we wanted to happen?
Yeah, there's a great lesson in there for life itself, isn't there?
Yeah, I think there is. And I think also, you know, not everything we do is also going to work out.
Yeah.
So even though we have these dreams and fantasies and desires for things to work out a certain way, they don't always. That's definitely also something that's included in the book.
Yeah.
Some of these characters definitely are trying to pursue something that goes completely awry, often hilariously, but sometimes very tragically.
Uh-huh.
And that's kind of the flip side.
Yeah, but at least they did it rather than...
Yeah, they tried.
Yeah, wonder what
they
if.
Weren't just,
yeah,
they weren't just sitting at home. Waiting.
Yeah. Does the critical success of this book, Dina, does it give you confidence to try another genre, say? Like say, the novel, if you will?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Actually, when I was in grad school, I did write a novel, but I don't know if it will ever see other human eyes.
Well, I'll give it 10 years, right?
Yeah, we'll see. Exactly. I need to, like, let it marinate for a minimum a decade.
Now, what's it like when you do get these good reviews? Is there, say, the burden of expectation on you as a writer for the next project, say, that it's got to be like this or be as well-received as this?
I think that's always going to be a part of it. But at the same time, things move so quickly that, I don't know, maybe it's hopeful or maybe it's just, again, fear. But to think, oh, well, people are going to forget about how well-reviewed that was by the time something else shows up.
Did you know while you were writing this you had something that was good? I always wonder when I talk to authors and you know they're out promoting a book that's getting good notices, whether they expected that or whether they knew that was going to be the case as they're sitting alone writing it.
I think that for the most part, you obviously don't know how it's going to be received.
Yeah.
So there's fear in that because you're in this insular place. I mean, I did get a lot of feedback from friends, Daniel Zamparelli, my work partner of many different avenues, read the stories and the manuscript, and he went through it. So I did, and over the years, you know, some of the stories had been in workshops, some had been through my writing group that I've been in since 2004. So people had seen these stories, and I think that if you don't want to keep writing them, that's a sign. But if you do want to keep writing them, that means that they have some value to you. Mm-hmm. You think there's something worth finishing.
You mentioned Daniel, your collaborator. Can't Lit continues, even though he's not there.
Can't Lit continues, yeah. He will return, and we will record more Can't Lits together, yeah. But I've had a really great co-host, Jen Sukfong Lee. She's amazing.
She is, isn't she? I follow her on Twitter, and I read
her
stuff.
Yeah, her Twitter is beautiful.
I mean, that recent essay that she did about her friend who's sick, oh, man.
I know. It's, yeah.
Beautiful piece.
It's so touching. It's so beautiful. She's a real inspiration. Her and Daniel both, they just do so much work and are so thoughtful and generous with their writing and time for me. Yeah, they're both wonderful.
And it's a great show. As you know, I'm a regular listener.
Yeah, you're one of our fans.
I love the conversation, and I like the fact that you and the guests can have a drink or two.
If we choose to, we can have a drink. There's very often, this is the perfect time of year, there's always Halloween candy around.
Yeah, yeah.
Little snacks. Yeah. Pretty good.
What's the next book? Are you working on something now?
I'm working on a poetry collection. I actually finished and sent off that manuscript about 18 months ago, but it's finally going to get edited, and that should be out in 2019.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, trying to work on a novel.
And you've got other activities. You know, you have the Real Vancouver Writers Series.
I've got Real Vancouver Writers Series, of course. We have an event actually on November 18th.
Where's that?
That will be at, what's it called? It's 750 Hamilton.
Oh, okay, yeah.
It's a great little space, and yeah, I'm pretty excited about it. It's going to be really fun.
And how's Cranberry to work with?
Cranberry's great. We actually, today, Sean Cranberry and I had a little meeting and went to look at the venue and check everything out and make sure it was all good.
Yeah.
So that was nice.
Well,
to be able to actually see the space. Sometimes he gets to see the venue because I am day jobbing,
so
I'm not always available during the week. But today I was able to go and check out the venue, so that was lovely. Yeah, and we've already started planning some events for 2018. So,
yeah, it's a great series. You've got marvelous lineups. And unfortunately, I've never made it out to any of these. But from what I hear from people who have gone, just a fun evening.
Yeah, it's a very fun evening. We always have six readers, and we have a raffle. There's lots of great prizes every time.
Yeah,
it's very, very, very fun.
Yeah. What's it like now that this book is out and you've published three previous collections of poetry? Did you get asked a lot by aspiring writers, young writers, say, for advice, and how are you in terms of giving them advice?
I definitely get asked for advice, and for the most part, I give it.
Yeah.
I feel like it's important to be honest, but also to let them know that every experience is different. There are, I think, a lot of different ways to get published or to make your way into the literary scene.
Mm-hmm.
So I end up asking them a lot of questions about what they want and what they're working on and what they're doing and, you know, what their goals are. If they have a manuscript, if they're working on one, what they know about publishing. Because I've worked in many different areas, not just as a writer, but I've done some freelance publicity work. I've worked for sales reps, bookstores, all of these different areas where you get a strange and eclectic knowledge base. So
yeah.
I'm happy to relay whatever I can.
We complain
it's
about...
It's difficult to start out, and I know how that feels, and I remember, you know, not knowing what to do and feeling very on the outside of everything and not even looking in because I was just too nervous to try to even approach people.
Yeah, we complain about just how expensive this city is to live in, but it's such a rich, rich and vibrant place for you know, if you love books and you love writers and there's a variety of writing that comes out of this town.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, if we can afford to still live here. I was just today complaining that I don't know what I'll do because I kind of refuse to live anywhere else.
Yeah.
I'm very stubborn that I'm just going to float out to sea.
Yeah.
Live in a kelp bed forever.
I was reading, finally, I was reading an interview you gave another website, and you referred to a personality trait of yours and chalked it up to being a Leo. Do signs really explain people? I'm a Pisces, and I don't. I've never bought into that.
What's your sign? Let's talk about it.
I'm a Pisces.
You're a Pisces, okay.
So what does that? I mean, does that?
Well, here's the thing about it. There's what I think. I'm not as knowledgeable as many people, but I think there's these assumptions about every sign. So that a Pisces is like very sensitive.
Yeah, I've heard that.
And emotional, and you know, they require nurturing and all those kinds of things. But I mean, it's obviously individual to everyone.
Yeah.
And right now we're in Scorpio season, which I jokingly tweeted about yesterday that I'm blaming. I've had a very bad week.
Uh-huh.
A lot of not good things have happened. And it's been stressful, and I just realized it was Scorpio season, so I'm just going to blame it.
Yeah.
Because it's easy.
Yeah.
I don't have to, I can just chalk it up to, you know. But also, Daniel is a Scorpio, and he's one of the best people in the world.
Mm.
So Scorpios aren't bad. But yes, of course, the Leo. I mean, I'm definitely a classic extrovert, so...
Yeah, and then when you think about it, it does make sense, you know, when someone says what they are, and you sort of get to know them.
I mean, I like it, and I feel like it's very fun and interesting.
Yeah.
But I also understand, you know, that it's not for everyone.
Yeah.
We don't all want to get involved.
Do you get, when you read the paper and you read the thing, the whatever the blurb is of the day, and then they say they have those lucky numbers, so does it actually work if you play them in the lotto?
Oh, I've never, you know what? Numbers and me, we don't really get along. I find them confusing. I don't even play into this.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not good.
Well, I'll give it a shot, and I'll let you know. How's that?
Okay, I mean, that seems fair.
Yeah.
Are you going to buy a lottery ticket?
Yeah, because you see that in the paper, right?
They have the little thing. It's like, these are your lucky numbers.
Yeah.
You have to do it on the day.
Yeah, so I'll do that on Wednesday then, I guess.
A bird crapped on me last week, and I didn't buy a lottery ticket, so maybe I made a huge mistake, because I'm supposed to be lucky.
Yeah, I hear that. Yeah, that's huge.
Yeah. Also, I was wearing a dress printed with birds, and I had a bird necklace, so I was like...
It felt threatened.
I was like a target, yeah. Felt very targeted.
It's always fun to talk, Dina. This book, as I was telling you before we started, this is such a wonderful achievement. Congratulations on it, and continued good luck with it. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, and thank you for continuing to do this show. More podcasts, I say.
Oh, yeah. You know, I think if more people did this, we would be a much richer community for it.
Yeah, I think so, too. You know, there are a lot of new podcasts that have come out of the city recently, so it's good. It's good.
It's a good time, isn't it? Yeah.
It is a good time, yeah.
Yeah. Thanks, Dina.
Thank you so much.
The book is called Don't Tell Me What to Do. It's published by Arsenal Pulp Press. It's author Dina Delbucchia. Join me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunta.